It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream for? Is it for everybody or just the rich? And when you think about dreams, you don't just dream about doing your job. I'm sure. I have a feeling that part of the American dream for everybody is that you have a little time off. You can have the economic security to be able to play with your family, get together with your friends. That's part of the American dream, isn't it? Well, we're going to be talking about the Puritan work ethic, and that maybe for the future, our economic stability to reduce some of the incredible economic turbulence that's been going on for the past couple of years, that, well, maybe we need to do something about the whole notion of work, 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 and that's all we need to do. I'm very pleased that my guest to talk about this today is Sarah Seltzer, a writer in New York City, associate editor at Alternet. Sarah, thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Sarah has been published in the Washington Post, Ms. Magazine, and online at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, that liberal rag, The Nation, and the Christian Science Monitor. The fact that leisure is only accessible to the privileged is exactly why policy changes are needed, she writes, because if society's powerful continue to perpetuate the idea of being occupied with work as somehow being valuable, then they will do nothing to help shift the situation for the rest of the workforce, for those who have no choice but to be busy. And, Sarah, you also point out that another example of dangerously divided, two-tiered society, it recalls medieval times of, well, there were very few aristocrats and landed gentry holding all the power and wealth, living a remarkably leisure-filled life. And back then, 500 or so years ago, the vast majority of peasants were slaving away, never getting ahead, constantly being force-fed the religion of work longer and harder. Today in America, the accumulation of wealth yields much free time for play, but this is completely out of reach for most of us. For most of us, there used to be a big middle class. What does this situation yield in terms of long-term sustainability and societal stability?
Well, I think that, you know, there are a lot of questions there. I mean, for me, when I was researching this series of articles about work-life balance, you know, a lot of people really do believe that giving people flexibility to be with their families and take vacation and take sick leave and basically take care of their personal lives actually increases happiness and efficiency on the job. So what you're going to get if, you know, if the social structure continues to ebb away at that leisure time is a very dissatisfied and inefficient workforce. So, you know, I just, you know, after I wrote this series of articles, I have very, very close French friends who came over to the States and were talking about how much vacation they get every summer. And, you know, they have the ability, they work, you know, very middle class jobs that we would consider very middle class, teachers and so on, and they are able to travel and see the world, and when they come back to work, they are refreshed and ready to go and excited about their job. Whereas if you only have 2 weeks of vacation and it gets eaten up taking care of family members, doing all the things you don't have time to do with your work schedule, then your attitude towards your job and will become much more negative. And I just think that, you know, vacation time is really crucial. And the, one of the problems I identified in the story is this, this attitude called the busy trap that was written about in the New York Times earlier this summer that got a lot of attention, which is that if the uber wealthy and the uber successful stop valuing their own leisure time and don't, you know, and see being busy as a status symbol, I guess, then they will have less empathy for those further down the social ladder. And, you know, it's sort of exemplified by this David Brooks column where he says that, you know, fathers taking BlackBerry phone calls and sitting in on conference calls while their sons have piano lessons or their children have piano lessons is an example of, you know, productivity and being busy. And, you know, to compare taking a conference call in the waiting room of a piano lesson to the kind of work that most Americans do, which is really backbreaking, grueling, or repetitive manual labor, or even service jobs, is just absurd. And it shows how there's sort of a there's been a loss of touch between the so-called elites and everyone else in our country.
And it does seem that the old feudal society of the Middle Ages eventually, it wasn't really sustainable. There's a lot of people who were back then slaving away, never getting ahead. And, you had the French Revolution, things like that, and the aristocrats of France were so out of touch that allegedly Marie Antoinette said when she was told the people don't have enough bread to eat, she said, well, let them eat cake. And, you know, I tell you, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and there was a very large middle class, and many of the nation's founders recognized that you cannot have a republic. You cannot have a democracy unless people are educated and feel like they have a stake in the system. And I know an awful lot of people who, you know, they just work all the time. And as you say, there's not a lot of happiness there. But, you know, what about happiness? You know, isn't it the other side could say that, well, more leisure leads to less productivity. We are in a global economy now. I mean, everybody knows this, both Republicans and Democrats in the race for the November election are talking about jobs, jobs, jobs. We need more jobs. The world is speeding up. We have to catch up with that. That's, you know, all our lives we've heard that time is money. Mm-hmm. We've taken it to heart. And your article, you point out that there's a pervasive, as you say, belief that if you just work hard enough in America, you will succeed, and that any time spent with nose away from the grindstone is wasted. What's the history of this? And, you know, how long has it been this way?
So this is very much tied into the capitalist ethos, and in America specifically, it's tied into the concept of the Protestant or the Puritan work ethic.
Right.
And, you know, when the first group of colonists came to the Northeast in particular, the Puritans, their religious belief was that, you know, in order to, nobody knows who's saved, but in order to prove to the community that you are saved and you're a member of the elect and you're going to go to heaven,
right,
you have to be extremely, you know, virtuous and work really, really, really hard and have a strong work ethic. And this, you know, came about also during the dawn of capitalism when the idea that, I mean, before capitalism, there was the idea that there was sort of a fixed amount of wealth and everyone tried to get the biggest piece of the pie. And in capitalism is the idea that, you know, you can keep growing wealth and growing wealth. The more you work, the more it grows. And this is all very much rooted in the kind of in the American psyche, and the association of work with virtue is rooted deeply in the American psyche. And, you know, I the idea that sort of sitting around and thinking, dreaming, or spending quality time with the family doesn't always fit in with that picture. Particularly, I think recently because of this speed up that you're talking about. And there was a really great article in Mother Jones, I think last year in 2011, about called The Great American Speed Up, where it was documented that, you know, more people are doing more work in less time, and jobs like executive assistants and office managers are getting eliminated, and people are kind of being expected to do it themselves. And I can personally attest that as a 20-something, I'm seeing my generation and my friends are doing more work for less money than the previous generation, because people feel that they're lucky to just have a job at all. So when I went, when I went about sort of looking at economic thought on progressive economic thought on work-life balance, I was really interested by some theories that believe that instead of having, that we need to have a slowdown to counter the speed up.
Oh.
And instead of having fewer people doing more work, we should have more people doing fewer work. And that it would be better to have, more people who are employed working, say, 80% of the time, than to have so many unemployed, which leads to social instability, and the people who are employed, working backbreaking cycles. And that really was sort of fascinating to me, because what happens when you have more people who are employed and can make a living but have a little bit more spare time? You might find that, people are doing very creative things, growing their own food or creating fascinating art or becoming entrepreneurs, and it could inject a lot of interesting energy into our society, in addition to giving more people the opportunity to make a living. So, it's called a plenitude economy,
mm-hmm.
And it was a really fascinating idea to me. And they also, a number of articles I looked at also noted that in Germany, which sort of everyone has been praising for cutting programs and for austerity, actually one of the reasons that they've survived the recession is because they've mandated that 80%, that new hires, that there'd be more new hires doing less work, basically. So there's job sharing going on, and that's actually helped that country weather the recession.
There's a lot to talk about here. We're talking with Sarah Seltzer about addressing the economic turbulence by really looking at, I suppose, the work ethic. And I can imagine people on the right saying, oh, my God, a slowdown? Here we have this, world economy that's sped up. We're talking about more people having time off to do what they want. Aren't we isn't that kind of really anti-capitalist? I mean, my goodness.
It is an alternative economic model. But it's not, I would say it's not un-American, and it actually might work in a way that focusing on creating jobs might not. The question might be, the question one might pose to our right wing, our friends on the other mm-hmm. side of the political mm-hmm. spectrum is, don't you wish that you could spend more time with your family? How much of a pay cut would you accept to be able to be there for your children's graduation from school, to be there at the end of your parents' lives, to be there, when somebody in your family is sick or has a milestone, and to not worry that you're going to lose your job. Again, we have these insane discussions about the mommy wars and, should women take maternity leave if it's given to them, and what companies' policies are. And there are so many workers in our country who can't even take, who will get, illegally fired if they're pregnant, or at risk of losing their job if they're pregnant, and who can't take a day off to take care of their sick kids. We don't even have paid sick leave. So improving a lot of those things, I think, would help with, worker retention, worker morale, and, as you said, sort of investment in the economy, people's personal investment in the economy and their workplaces and our society overall. A happier populace is a populace that's more invested in improving and being personally involved in society at large.
And I wonder about the stability aspect of it. I mean, here we are again in the incredibly intense competitive world economy. What you're talking about here, doesn't that endanger the American competitiveness? For example, look at Greece. Now, do we want to become another Greece that's having, the economy is just in a total shambles? A lot of people feel like, the reason Greece is in such terrible economic shape is because they've taken time off. They're not as devoted to the, absolute, you know, puritanical work ethic, and look what happened to them. So, you know, because they don't work as hard, they're not so dedicated to the work ethic, that's why their economy is in trouble. We don't want to go in that direction, do we? And I wonder how you answer critics like that.
You know, I'm not a huge expert on the international economy, but I would say that the examples I saw of how the work sharing in Germany actually helped improve their economy through the recession by increasing employment is a really good counterexample. And also that, you know, unemployment is what's caused a lot of the unrest in Greece. We have people on the streets who don't have a job and don't have leisure, and that's caused instability in that society. And if more people were working, fewer jobs, you might find more productivity. And I also think, you know, you can't really, I mean, the fact is Americans value their work. It's part of our social ethos. And talking about sort of tweaking it in certain ways to remake the model so that more people are working perhaps fewer hours is not going to change the devotion that Americans have to their work. Uh-huh. And I also think that it might increase it because
right.
People will be able to be devoted to a job and have the personal sense of satisfaction that comes from work, but they will have maybe that extra day a week to pursue their own projects and their own dreams. And we're creative people. And in other reporting I've done for Alternet, there are studies that say that entrepreneurship has decreased in our country. It hasn't gone up. And part of that, I think, is because of the huge squeeze on working Americans who they don't have time to sort of take a step back and come up with new ideas. So it might actually increase entrepreneurship and investment in the economy to have these kind of work share programs instituted.
Well, it does seem like a lot of people, a lot of adults would love to get more education. This is a quandary that a lot of people face who are in jobs that they're really not crazy about, is that they'd love to improve themselves, gain more skills, gain more knowledge, more expertise, so that they can increase, you know, their not only their money, but, you know, be able. I mean, one of the goals of getting more money is to be able to spend it and have, you know, spend a little time. As they say, Benjamin Franklin, time is money. You want to spend time and spend money. And I'm, of course, remembering, oh, just about 100 years ago, maybe a little more than that, actually, when Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, came out. And the whole notion back then of a mere 40-hour work week, there were the captains of industry, as it were, that very much were against that. You can't give people time off. People got to work 10, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, or our economy will fall apart. And it seems like a lot of people on the right now who have taken over the Republican Party, and I must say it bothers me when they use the word on the media, the mainstream media, conservative. They're not conservative, they're right wing. But this is what they want to do. They want to do away with any and all regulations on this and just, you know, maybe go back to the 50-hour work week and things like that. It's been part of American history, and it didn't, I don't think, by going to the 40-hour work week, it made us a weaker economy in and of itself. I think it probably increased our productivity. And I will tell you that I grew up at a different time when you have, Sarah. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and it seemed back then that progress meant more labor-saving devices. Mm-hmm. New appliances, washing machines, dishwashers, and things that could save you time. Less work was desirable and a good thing. And so there was that message. Are we still getting such mixed messages, you know, time-saving devices and, you know, things to... but then again, maybe these devices are just, cutting down on drudgery so you can do the important work, you know, the real... money-making work. Whatever happened to that that notion that people, Americans, would invent great things to save, you know, back-breaking labor?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think certainly, so obviously the biggest technological leap in the last period of time has been the internet and things like smartphones right. and iPads. And so in some ways they do make things a lot more efficient, but in others we're always tethered to our work. And
yes,
I think that
exactly.
that leads into the fallacy. I mean, it's very hard to disconnect now. You have to really, you know, go to an island that doesn't have Wi-Fi or something to truly disconnect. And, you know, I think that also, you know, has added to this problematic attitude of, well, I'm always working because I'm always on email and corresponding with, you know, my colleagues. And, you know, I think that that again should not be a measure of policy, because again, somebody who's changing the sheets at your hotel room when you're traveling and using your Wi-Fi and connecting with your office, you know, she can't, you know, working 12 hours for her is 12 hours of changing sheets, whereas for you it might be 8 hours in the office and then 4 hours on your email at home or while you're traveling. So the standards that we apply for the elite class, that quote-unquote elite, that uses mm-hmm. this technology shouldn't be the standards that apply across the board, because it's not the same kind of work. And, you know, I think that part of the problem is that technology makes us feel important. You know, I'm guilty of it. Because I'm a freelancer, I'm constantly checking my email because I don't really have a regularized schedule. And you know, it's important to remember, okay, well, this is not necessarily what being on the clock means for somebody else. You know, having to stop whatever I'm doing and check my email and maybe fire off a response to an editor or a source. So I think that you know, that technology has complicated our lives a little bit. And I, you know, what I thought was very interesting in the New York Times piece called The Busy Trap that kind of started me on this journey of looking into work-life balance is the idea that among the elites, claiming to be busy is this, you know, way of warding off existential angst. And, you know, saying, well, I'm so busy, I'm not going to sit around and think about, well, what my life really means, and have I gotten enough time to spend with my family, and, you know, is this job, you know, is this life that I lead actually personally fulfilling? You don't have time. I mean, I think anyone who goes through a period of being busy in that sense can tell you that in some ways it's a relief, because you don't have to think about these bigger questions about the future and the past and whatever. But that is not the same as being busy working, you know, two shifts, you know, working a night shift and at a restaurant or a hospital, being a ward nurse. It's not the same kind of busyness, and we shouldn't, you know, the people in power shouldn't kind of use that as an excuse not to make sure that all that work is really labor is really regulated, and that that middle class people are able to access leisure and, as you said, time to improve themselves, to go back to school, to take a class, to learn another language, to learn more skills. That's really important for forward momentum. And I think that's another answer to your question about is it anti-capitalist. I would say that, you know, a little bit more free time can go a long way in terms of helping people improve themselves and climb the social ladder and the economic ladder.
Yeah, I don't think the, you know, reducing the work hours to 40 hours a week was anti-capitalist, although it was portrayed as anti-capitalist back then. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Sarah Seltzer about the work ethic and, you know, what it means, what the price we pay is in the United States. And I think it's fascinating you talk about existential angst. I know a lot of people who, you know, if they're not go, 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 go all the time, every single second of the day, they don't know what to do with themselves. You know, and I see younger people these days, you know, whose thumbs never stop working their smartphone, you know, just mm-hmm. never, ever stop. And we're called human beings. We're not human doings. And
that's great.
And I wonder about, well, I didn't make it up. I can't claim credit for it, but it is a good phrase. It's always seemed to me that part of the work ethic, part of, you know, the capitalist system is that the idea that you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead so that you can take time off and enjoy things in life, that's part of the goal, to be like, you know, the old aristocrats and financial elite, that, you know, more and more people can do that. But it seems like these days fewer and fewer people can actually achieve that there's this, you know, just religion of work all the time, and at the same time, you know, I don't think history is ever linear. You know, it's always moving in a bunch of different directions. I note that yoga is becoming more popular, and that's more mm-hmm. just sitting where you are and being.
Yeah, I think the popularity of yoga is a direct response to sort of the accelerated pace of our lives in the past decade or whatever. I think that's why yoga has exploded, because it's kind of like a counterbalance to it. I mean, it helps sort of erase the scars of an intense day at the office. But yeah, that's also the kind of thing that's like, well, if we urban professionals are able to enjoy yoga, you know, why shouldn't people who do manual labor, our nannies, our housekeepers, the people who make the city run, they should be able to do yoga too. And, you know, and if they're working a certain number of hours a week and then they have to take care of their children, when are they going to get to do yoga? So, you know, I think that, you know, it's important to remember that the things that are valued by one should be accessible to all. And in terms of what you said about, people wearing their busyness as a badge of pride. I mean, yes. I find it really shocking personally when people brag about not being able to take a vacation.
Right.
Because to me, you know, the best part of every year is, you know, the week or two of vacation I take. I love working. I'm a very, you know, I'm a hard worker and I get a lot of satisfaction from my work, but nothing compares, how can that compare to spending time with my family somewhere nice? So I think that's why I've been so sort of fascinated by this discussion, because I really worry that if journalists and politicians and particularly people I think in the banking and finance industries are going around saying, well, I'm important, I can't take a vacation,
right.
Well, how are they going to step in and protect vacation for everyone else? You know, these are the policymakers, really. I think it's really important that we remind ourselves that, you know, this is why we're supposed to be working, so we can have that time with people that we care about. And when we come back, and I always find that when I come back from vacation, if it's been a satisfying vacation, I'm really ready to work, and I have new ideas. I think one thing I wrote about in this series of articles is that a number of tech companies, you know, startups are changing their vacation policy around. Some of them are mandating like that random employees take 2 weeks off by a lottery, and that enables the company to figure out what that person does and why it's valuable. And that person will have to, before they go away, before he or she goes on vacation, explain to his or her colleagues, this is my function, this is how you can do what I need to do. So it improves communication. It's good for office morale. And then others have an open vacation policy, which is sort of take however many days you want when you need it. So some people, instead of saving up their vacation days all year and running away for 2 weeks at Christmas, will take that, you know, those 2 days a month to take care of a child or a relative, or just to, you know, go away for a long weekend. And what happens is the vacation days end up not being bunched up, and it really improves sort of the trust relationship between the employees and the firm. People say, well, they trust me to take the vacation that I need. You know, I can trust my employer, and I'll work extra hard when I am here. So I think that was a very interesting policy, and the companies that implemented that kind of policy say they do believe that, you know, that kind of vacation policy makes more loyal and efficient workers.
And people, you're right, come back refreshed for sure. And I notice I have a daughter who's going to a very challenging academy, and she works her tail off. But in the summertime, she's been sleeping late. She's actually been getting a little bit bored. She's fired up to go back to school soon. And I think, you know, it's a great thing. You need that little bit to be more productive, I think. Now, you know, you talk about wearing, I'm too busy to take a vacation, as a badge of honor, and kind of, you know, people look down on those that take time off. So if one doesn't subscribe to this harsh Puritan work ethic, doesn't that mean one is a lazy bum?
I think, you know, people have different kinds of temperaments, but I would sort of argue that it's often people like that who end up, you know, suffering from burnout Or, you know, leaving their jobs because they can't take it anymore. So, you know, an important balance is kind of healthy, is healthy for retaining someone's interest and that generation of new ideas and new approaches of looking at things. I mean, it's a cliche, but the idea of, you know, getting physical distance from your problems does help you often gain perspective on them, and that includes work problems and, you know, how to break through and reach an audience, you know, whatever your job is. Or, you know, how to make the routine at your job more interesting. That can often be found when you spend time away. But I think it's also important to remember that our country, I mean, we are very behind on all these issues of work-life balance. We're not even talking about vacation here. We have no paid maternity leave. We are the only industrialized country in the world with no paid maternity leave. We don't have paid sick days. We have, you know, less mandated vacation time than many other countries. And a lot of Americans don't even take their vacation time.
They can't afford to.
Because they can't afford to, exactly. Right. Or they end up using it for crises. So, you know, we're so far behind on some of these very basic issues. And we're trying to, in New York City, where I am right now, we're trying so hard to get a paid sick leave bill passed, which would just require, you know, something that seems so common sense, which is that restaurants and other industries, you know, give workers, you know, a very few number of paid sick days so they can take care of their sick children or you know, to go to the doctor. And it's being fought very hard by people, you know, even not even on the right wing, but sort of the mainstream pro-business center. And it just seems really unfortunate. And personally, I don't want sick people preparing my food at a restaurant. And you know, if a child, and as a teacher, I can certainly say that if a child is sick, his or her, I used to be a public school teacher, and if a sick child came into school, the whole school would be sick within a week. So these kinds of, like, sick leave provisions are common sense, and they're still being, you know, they're being passed in some cities, but they're still not nationalized in any way. And it's really unfortunate that we don't have those kinds of policies. And again, that means people end up taking their own time to take care of family emergencies. And it
doesn't help. It really, I think it could be argued, it doesn't help our overall economic strength and our economic security. And there has been a tremendous amount of turbulence lately. There are those who call for more austerity measures, and it's being fought in places like Greece and Spain and Italy and things like that, so that the working people are burdened with even more work and, you know, higher taxes. But I wonder what, you know, what kind of technical nitty-gritty answers there could be. Are there people talking about, well, a 30-hour work week, a three-day work week, something like that, as some people call for, you know, people on the right call for raising the retirement age so that people have to work till, you know, 67, 70, 75, whatever. The opposite of that might be lowering the retirement age and reducing the work week. What do you know about the nuts and bolts?
Economist that I came across, her name is Juliette Shore, and she's the one who talks about the concept of the plenitude economy. And she talks about a 4-day a week, an 80% work week. As an interesting model.
And how could we survive that way? I mean, does that mean, say, a business with, I don't know, 40, 50 employees, has people working at, you know, a certain salary per year for 40-hour week? If they're working, you know, less than that, do they have to pay them the same amount? And doesn't that hurt business, you know, hurt their competitiveness?
I think that it, she says, if jobs are restructured to require fewer hours, employers will have to hire more people for a given level of sales.
Right.
If work time were allocated more equitably, it would not only reduce unemployment, there would be wider benefits to all workers, their families, and communities. So in other words, she's basically saying exactly what you said, which is that we have followed a path of hours reduction for decades.
Yes, that's true.
So in between 1870 and 1970, the working hours in most Western countries fell from 3,000 to less than 2,000. So workers who lost their jobs due to technological change and the Industrial Revolution were reabsorbed into the labor market because of falling hours. So this is basically what's happening still in Europe, particularly in Germany. She says that they contained unemployment by reducing hours. So they mandated that new hires be hired for reduced hours. So the one issue that she brings up and that I have is that if you're hiring 5 workers where you used to have 4, you're going to have to probably give benefits to that 5th worker. But she believes that ultimately, if that is a change that's instituted across the board, it will be sort of a money saving venture for the companies. And she also is a big believer that this is going to be key for the environment.
Say more about that.
Other category, but she thinks that if we have all these workers working 4 days a week, they'll be using their 5th day to many of them will be doing sustainable things because we're living in this moment where everyone is into raising their own food and growing, doing things more locally. So instead of, traveling on that 5th day and commuting, people will be staying close to home, and that would be ultimately good for the environment, and possibly, working in their gardens or whatever, and creating more of a community network. So she's a big believer that this will have repercussions across the board.
Well, that's one thing.
She says that people strongly prefer to gain free time at the expense of income they haven't yet received. So in other words, instead of cutting people's paychecks, we're talking about when we hire new people, we're hiring them at 80%.
And they have.
So people are going to prefer that that new job to no job at all, and they might even want the free time.
And there's plenty of things that people can do with that tap into their creativity and American ingenuity. If you're just a slave to something, you don't have a minute to think about anything else. Where is that creativity, that ingenuity that has clearly made a lot of improvements over the last couple hundred years or so? There has to be that ability to do that. And I've noticed, people who... There's a lot of people, Democrats, liberals, progressives, whatever, who, go along with the labor community saying jobs, 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 we need more jobs. And yet, at the same time, a lot of us know in the back of our minds, the environment really can't handle that. I mean, just boosting the gross domestic product just for the sake of boosting the gross domestic product. People who care about the environment have long pointed out that we just can't keep grinding out more stuff, more junk that so quickly ends up in landfills. I mean, the idea of making more stuff, creating more jobs, there are a lot of people who feel like, just make stuff, just jobs, And we have these public works jobs now called the defense industry, which makes terribly useless and destructive things that don't do anything. But we're so dependent on that for part of our economy, it's not sustainable for the planet. So the quandary seems to be that we need these jobs, but the Earth really can't keep handling the making of more and more crap, if you will. So maybe, what we're talking about here, Sarah, is something that can help address how we can preserve the environment as well as sanity.
I think that, that's definitely something that, her idea encompasses. And she really believes that the slowdown will be not only good for the environment, but crucial. And she thinks that we're going to have some major environment. I mean, I think anyone who studied climate change thinks we're going to have some major environmental shocks in the next, in the coming decades, and possibly economic as well. And so if you have people who are, figuring out how to be sustainable on a more local level, that will help us weather those storms. And sort of create a local interdependence that will be very helpful. And I think that some people in the labor community are becoming aware of this. There's some blue-green coalitions. Mm-hmm. And also, one thing I came across is that unions are being more aggressive in advocating for this work-life balance stuff because they recognize that it's not just about job creation, but also about making life more bearable for the workers who are there. So there's more, you hear more talk about maternity leave and sick leave and things like that, which I think are really, really important.
You reminded me of a phrase from the Lawrence Mill strike in 1912 when a lot of the women workers went on strike. One of their chants was bread and roses, too. We want bread, but we want roses, too.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are a full century later, and this is what we're talking about. So do tell us, you've mentioned Juliette Shore a few times, the plenitude economy. I wonder if you could describe more a bit about what she means by plenitude economy. What would that look like?
So for her, it's the idea that we have a work sharing and furlough system that will minimize layoffs during this recession.
Furlough.
And so instead of making everyone, so she calls it what we have is share the pain measures where hours are increased and salaries are decreased but instead she recommends 4-day work weeks for new hires. And or instead of just firing people, reducing people's workload to 4 days a week, new employees can be hired on an 8% schedule. I'm reading from a piece she wrote up for The Nation called Beyond Business as Usual that I found throughout my research. She recommends basically that the government incentivize this kind of thing. So tax credits for companies that do this work share kind of thing. And she believes that the carbon footprint, our national carbon footprint will actually get smaller because instead of people, as you said, instead of spending going into the economy, people have more free time. And what they're doing during that extra, let's say they have that, you know, that extra Wednesday off, is not consuming. They're not running out to work, out to the deli for lunch, but they're making their own.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're working, as we said, they're working in their urban garden, or they're, you know, walking to the local, farmer's market, or they're, fixing things on their own at home to make them more sustainable. So we have less transportation, less consumption, and that reduces our impact on the environment. So she cites a study from the Center for Economic and Policy Research that says that if we went to the same kind of work patterns that we have in Western Europe, and I mentioned my very close French friends who just arrived in the States, who get, 6 weeks of vacation in the summer and 3-day weekends and shorter work days. She says that this study says that energy use overall would fall by 20% in our country.
Wow.
If our work patterns were adjusted to, say, those of Western Europe. And so that we'd have a smaller ecological footprint.
Goodness.
So, and people would be spending more time with their communities. And they're, providing things for themselves.
And that's one big problem, I think, these days is this isolation that people feel. You know, people are chained to their computers, and they don't connect as much with other people in the community. And all kinds of studies have shown over the years, you got to feel connected to the community. You know, being isolated, it's not healthy. It doesn't make for a happy life. But being connected to your community is just a great thing. And, I'm reminded of, I was a kid in the crowd of the Woodstock generation, and many of us at the time questioned the obsession with work at the expense of play and non-money-oriented activities. We've now kind of lived a pretty long time with the belief that we need not just hard work, that work is fun. If it's something you love, it's great. It's like not work. But not just that work, but also a sense of aesthetics into our daily lives and each and every day. And going to art museums, bringing art. And I find there are people who say, who would dismiss art. Oh, please. We don't need art education in the schools. We don't need music education in the schools. But as far as I can tell, being part of a community, having a sense of art and music and participating with that is really essential for our health. And I would imagine actually may in the long run improve the economy as well, because people are...
I definitely agree. And I also think, for instance, you have that extra day a week and you spend part of it, let's say you're practicing a musical instrument or taking an art lesson.
Right.
Or if you're an athlete, you're playing basketball or getting a chance to take a long run, whatever. That, if that desire already exists in you, and I think it exists in most people, either to do something physical or creative or meditative, like you were talking about yoga or taking long walks, whatever, that is outside of the traditional work paradigm, that side of you will be nurtured and refreshed. And then when you go into work, I think you will often find that you are more productive because
yes.
that need has been satisfied and you don't feel the need to, you're not sitting at work feeling that itch to do something musical or creative. Instead, that need is satisfied and you're able to focus on work. And I certainly have found that to be true when I started a grad school program in creative writing, my journalistic writing took off because I was so satisfied with my grad school work that I came to my work with just a really improved efficiency, and I was writing a lot more and, writing better in addition. So I am a huge proponent of that.
And the idea that if
you spend more time, with the arts and physical, everyone's watching the Olympics and, I think we don't get to spend enough time sort of nurturing our physical selves either.
That's true. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Sarah Seltzer about less economic turbulence, more stability, and just healthier lives. And years and years ago, there was a candidate for president, former senator from Oklahoma, Fred Harris, who said, if you draw a map of high unemployment and you draw a map of high crime, you're drawing the same maps. People get frustrated if there's high unemployment, if people want to be able to survive, if they're chained down on their jobs and they see a few people who, this is the goal. We've always been brought up with, make more money so you can have some leisure time, so you can have some fun. If people never get that, I got to believe, it doesn't excuse any kind of crime for sure, but people get frustrated. As Bob Dylan said, another quote, if you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And if people have something, then they have something, to gain, obviously. And that, it brings up the question of, to me anyway, of the basic notion of freedom. Everybody talks about freedom. It's more than just being able to own a gun. There's a lot more to freedom than that. What kind of freedom is there if there's no economic security? There's
absolutely. I mean, I actually read a chilling piece in Time Magazine's health blog this week that said that the only factor in the strongest sort of controlling factors in the rise of these mass shootings very unfortunately seen this month is income stratification. And that everything you were just talking about, social isolation,
yes.
And people feeling disconnected from each other
mm-hmm.
in a society will lead to these, there is a correlation, let's put it this way. There's
yes.
a strong correlation between that and the incidence of these kinds of horrific crimes. And so the concept of the plenitude economy, which believes that, if people are working 80% and then reinvesting the rest of the time in their communities, means that we will feel more connected to each other and not just based on who you work with, but also your neighbors and your family, and the people who share other aspects of life with you, whether, maybe it's, people in your local arts group or your faith group or whatever it is. So that sense of connectedness will actually be very good for social stability. People also, if people know each other in the community, then maybe they can keep an eye out for problems in a way that I don't think in our busy... in our busy society as it is, it's much harder to notice the people who do slip through the cracks.
Well, it's true. I think these days the idea that, we're all in the same boat together, not so much. It's more like every person for him or herself, dog eat dog. And yikes, that doesn't make for a good virtuous society. I think the concept of virtue is an interesting one. It hasn't been talked about in a couple hundred years or so. But, I think it does bring up the reality of virtue as being so essential for a stable society, for a republic, government of, by, and for the people to be able to be a good neighbor, be a part of the community, be contributing to the community. And if people are so isolated and chained to their work, they don't have time to do that. And I wonder about, as I was preparing for this, a friend emailed me that Scandinavian countries, I don't know what their economic stability is, but she pointed out that citizens pay about 50% of their income in taxes, but they get free neonatal and child care, free education through the doctoral level, mandatory maternal and paternal leave, minimum of 6 weeks vacation a year, free health care, free elder care, and more. They have nowhere near the income disparity that we do, which is key to making a better life for everyone. How is it fairly stable over there, their economy?
I believe so. I mean, we haven't really, I mean, yes, we've heard about
Germany.
Hey, about Southern Europe, like you said, suffering, Spain, Italy, and Greece. But I haven't read any headlines about Scandinavian countries having the same level of economic turbulence. And an interesting story is from Iceland, where the people voted out the austerity government, and then the new government, I'm summarizing it in
sure.
a very basic way, but the new government did everything that sort of the American government did not do. So they, instead of bailing out the banks, they actually jailed the architects of the financial crisis there and redistributed the wealth, at least to a certain extent. And their economy has actually rebounded. So it was the opposite of the austerity approach. It's not an example that's discussed, but it is really interesting that Iceland kind of shares some of that Scandinavian ethos.
And people are pretty happy and feel like they're part of their society.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, the only way we can get out of this economic crisis here in America is austerity, you know, keep, you know, taxes really low for the rich, the idea that they'll create jobs. Yeah, right, as if that ever worked. But make everybody else work harder and suffer more. There's got to be an alternative that might help stabilize employment and the general economy. And it sounds mm-hmm. like what you're talking about might really be part of that. Do you sense any, is there much talk about this? Are there people who are running for government or who you know, there may be talk about a little bit on the blogs and places like The Nation and others, but do you sense, is it starting to bubble up and gain, you know, because the austerity stuff ain't working, you know, and just having the economy just run, you know, a government plutocracy of, by, and for the very rich isn't creating economic stability. So is there more talk of this happening, do you think? Or are there organizations that are helping to push this idea of better balance?
Well, I know that there's been a push for a sick leave bill in mm-hmm. Congress. Obviously, because of the GOP-controlled Congress, it hasn't gone very far.
Yeah.
But there are people who are pushing for it. I would also say that the Occupy was very helpful in refocusing the conversation on away from the deficit and austerity to the real problem of income inequality. And you know, I don't think that effect has completely worn off, although it has to some extent. But I also think that those high profile articles that in the New York Times and the Atlantic this summer about women not being able to have it all, and the difficulty of, and the busy trap, and the difficulty of work-life balance, show that there is to a certain extent among, again, this sort of group of self-styled social and political elites who write for the New York Times and the Atlantic, there's at least somewhat of a pushback against this ethos of, you know, virtue. You know, work is virtue, and being busy is virtue. So that is, I think, an important first step, that, you know, the people who kind of set the social rules are saying, well, maybe it would be cool if I could spend some time with my family and also advance in my career.
Well, that's
be nice, you know. So
we've all heard for many, many years that, you know, the old thing about, you know, on somebody's deathbed, they're not saying, gee, I wish I could have been at my job more, spent more time at the office. And you know, they realize that there's more to life than that. And, you know, kind of everybody knows that. But to make this a reality for more people, that's going to take some effort and change. Because right now, okay, the top 1%, maybe the top 5%, whatever. But it's not reaching enough people.
Definitely agree. And that's why I wrote the articles, because I feel like the conversation is just beginning. And it's important to get the idea, you know, just get people thinking along these other lines. Well, what would it be like if I worked 4 days a week and had less of a salary? Well, maybe I wouldn't be able to pay as much rent, but I could, you know, reinvest in whatever, in my, you know, in my cooking, and I wouldn't have to spend so much money eating out. So I might save money that way, and I would also be able to spend time with my kids. So it's interesting to at least start thinking that way and spreading the idea, because it just makes a lot of sense to me. And that maybe because I'm somebody who, personally, I find that a little bit of leisure time for me goes a long way in my productivity. So it makes a lot of sense in terms of how I work. And so it kind of like all these bells were going off in my head when I was reading these stories. But I think that a lot of people are like that. I don't think I'm unique. And I think that reducing hours might really work well in a lot of areas and in making our country a better place and our communities better.
Yeah, sounds good. It's interesting how many people, as you mentioned, I don't have time to cook. So they go out to eat and spend a heck of a lot more money. Yeah. Sarah Seltzer, thanks very much for being with us. You can find her at www.sarahmseltzer.com or tweeting, I don't do that yet, at Sarah M. Seltzer. Thanks very much for being with us. And there's a lot more to life than just work. Thanks, Sarah, for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. And do email me, bert@bertcohen.com.
This dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and fresh, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time. So young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due. Yes, you will. See my daddy in bed. Oh, you know it, baby, and I know it too, baby.